Good afternoon, and welcome to Spokane Public Radio's Northwest Arts Review, a half hour exploring the people, places, and events forming the rich arts tapestry we enjoy here in the Inland Northwest and our wider Intermountain Northwest region. I'm Jim Tevenin, pleased to be your guide on this journey. Today, Chris Massini introduces us to Emeritus History Professor Carlos Gill, the next speaker in the Diversity Dialogues series at Spokane Community College. We'll happily hear again from the Spokane Symphony Orchestra's James Lowe, this time actually in our studio, talking with Vern Windham. Kevin Hekmatpana has some music for us from his upcoming collaboration with the Gonzaga University Dance. And Dan Webster reviews a new Netflix documentary. Taking us in and out is the Spokane Symphony Orchestra with some Beethoven from one of their last pre-pandemic concerts. This is Northwest Arts Review.
For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Massini. My guest today is Dr. Carlos Gill. He's an emeritus professor of history at the University of Washington, where he's taught the history of Latin America for over 30 years. He's the next speaker in Spokane Community College's Hagen Center for the Humanities Diversity Dialogues, for which Spokane Public Radio is a media partner. His presentation is titled, We Became Mexican American, How Our Immigrant Family Survived to Pursue the American Dream, based on his book of the same name. And it explores the Mexican immigration by spotlighting his own family's experience in Southern California, including parallels with Washington State. Carlos Gill, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for inviting me, Chris. I'm glad to be here.
So, immigration is, particularly across the southern border, is back in the news lately, and it's been a hot-button topic for a long time. In your book, you focus really on the personal story of your family, and your parents came to the United States in the 19-teens and 20s, and things were really different then. So give us a little intro. Who were your parents, and why did they originally cross the U.S.-Mexico border?
One of the main ideas that I try to get across in my talk is that people migrate for very specific, structural reasons. And those reasons or factors, if you want to call them factors, are political and economic and social most of the time, but mainly political and economic. So in the case of my parents, in the 19-teens and 1920s, Mexico was undergoing the so-called Mexican Revolution. And if you know anything about world history, the Mexican Revolution is one of the key upheavals in the 20th century. And in this case, a lot of the first major wave of Mexicans coming into the United States came as a result of the Mexican Revolution. And so I include my parents because my own ancestors were raised up by the revolution and thrown across the border. And yeah. So it so happens that at that time, the American West needed workers desperately. And so we're at World War I, more or less, in the 1920s. And so every Mexican that crossed the border had a job without having to ask for one.
Hmm.
They recruited people right on the spot within a couple of blocks from the border.
Yeah, that's so interesting that, you know, folks were recruiting, it sounds like, essentially people from Mexico to come across and work. And, you know, attitudes have obviously shifted, although, you know, generations of immigrants from all over the world have been coming here and working jobs that are really vital to the economy in the United States for a long time. I wonder, what parallels do you see with the sort of social factors that are both pushing and attracting migrants now versus when your parents came?
Well, right now, as we speak, the big immigration crisis, of course, as you know, is Central America. It involves people from Central America.
Yeah.
When we talk about Central America, we're talking about Guatemala, Honduras, and Salvador, primarily. And so in these three countries, they're expelling people, they're exporting people for political reasons more than economic. Yeah. And those are factors that have been going on in Central America, in those countries, for last 20 years, I think. I might add, too, the role of polleros, of guys who help people cross the border. And that role is really a little understood factor in the case of Central America. Because these are really bad actors, in my view. Because all they're doing is they're charging people thousands of dollars to guide them up to the American border. And so quite often these families, lacking any other credible information, they accept the arguments of these guys, and they pay money that they desperately hardly have, and they're led all the way up to the border. And of course, we're being overwhelmed, especially now with Biden in the White House. And so in many ways, these people are responding to the hope that a Democratic administration under Biden will accept them more easily. And that's very hard to do. Very hard to do.
I'm talking with Carlos Gil. He's an emeritus professor of history at the University of Washington and the next speaker in Spokane Community College's Diversity Dialogues series through the Hagen Center for the Humanities. Returning to your family story and your own story, because a lot of your talk and book is about becoming American and becoming Mexican-American. So your parents crossed the border, and so you grew up in the United States. And you talk about the experience of becoming American. So what did that process look like for your family, and how do you think that's different from, you know, immigrants from other parts of the world or in different times?
Well, the process in itself for us, my brothers and sisters, my parents, my cousins, you know, everybody, it was not easy, but it was silent. It was personal. And in some cases, it was anguishing. And I could even say traumatic. I make that argument in my talk, that in the case of the women in my family, my sisters in particular, it was a traumatic experience. And traumatic because of the culture clash. Because we were coming from backcountry Mexico in the teens and 20s with mores or moral principles that guided our personal behavior. And I maintain that that process of anguish and tension are universal. You don't have to be a Mexican. You don't have to be Guatemalan to go undergo what we went. Italians, Germans, Poles, Jews, no matter. We all undergo that process, but nobody else really knows about it or really cares about it. It's a very personal, anguishing process. It's easier on the children than on the adults. And so it's an experience that that I think is worthy of mentioning, and I go into it in my talk.
So you've been invited as part of a series the Hagen Center is doing called Diversity Dialogues, and so it's bringing in writers and poets and professors from different disciplines. And so as a historian and as also the child of an immigrant family, what do you hope to contribute to that larger discussion about, you know, diversity and inclusion?
Thankfully, I'm a historian. I say thankfully because history can involve sociology, it can involve economics, it can involve politics, depending on how the historian puts it together. And so I've always intermixed the various disciplines. And so history gives us a view of the past, but if you put it together with these other disciplines, it can provide an understanding of where we are at the present, and maybe even have an idea of what things might be in the future. I mean, that happens all the time when you have a historically minded view of things. It happens all the time.
My guest has been Dr. Carlos Gil, Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Washington and guest speaker at the Spokane Community College's Hagen Center for the Humanities Diversity Dialogues. He'll be hosting a virtual talk on Wednesday, April 15th. You can find more information about that event at the Spokane Community College's website or spokanepublicradio.org. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me, Chris.
For the better part of a year, it was my pleasure to keep up a Northwest Arts Review correspondence with Spokane Symphony Orchestra music director James Lowe. He had an extended and enforced stay at his home in Scotland. Fortunately for us, he is now back, really, not virtually, and has come to KPBX to talk with Vern Windham about many things, including a new Spokane Symphony concert series.
Talk about kind of this whole experience of the real reason we're here, which is getting into the music.
Well, the problem with pandemics is that, and as a musician, is that, you know, what we do is a live thing. It's two or more people in a room connecting in this language that is not verbal, which is an amazing thing. And you breathe together. And, you know, anybody who's sung in an online choir knows how hard it is to do these things virtually, just recording your own part. It's a really dry and unpleasant thing to do. So suddenly to be back on the Fox, and the first recording we made, the first week, was the large string ensemble. So we had all of these strings, and we played Vaughan Williams' five variants on Diogenes and Lazarus, a beautiful piece. And those first kind of shimmering chords as they emerged, oh, what a feeling that was to suddenly be breathing music together again live with each other. I mean, we were talking about this before we went on air. I still can't find the right words to describe that feeling. It was such a watershed moment for all of us.
If that's the first sound that you're going to hear after a year, and the first thing that people are going to play after a year, because you must have just all of a sudden felt not only the way you felt hearing that, but those people all felt that.
Who was it that said, you know, music starts where words leave off? And I think that's something that we've missed so much this year, is that our communication has been all over Zoom and all verbal, and you cannot make music over the internet. It just doesn't work. There's some amazing technology just emerging now that does cut down the lag, but it's kind of complicated, and you've got to be in the same area and near a server and all this kind of stuff. But this feeling that you know, we've missed this live communication that transcends language, that transcends words, at least. Mm. I suddenly felt plugged back into the Matrix again.
Is it an actual folk song?
It is, and it's found all around the UK and Ireland. And Vaughan Williams, obviously, you know, he loved folk song and would go around transcribing it by hand or recording it, like Bartok does, who also features in the programme. And he loved it so much, he made a hymn tune out of it. So we have the Spokane Symphony Chorale doing a virtual choir singing the hymn tune as an introduction to this. So you can hear how he took the tune in different ways. And it's called Five Variants of this tune, not Five Variations, because unlike the normal variation form where you just have a theme and you fool around with it as a composer, the idea with folk music is, of course, it's like the game of telephone. You know, it's passed from ear to ear to ear to ear, and it evolves over time. And you hear these different versions pop up everywhere. So you've got that beautiful kind of hymn tune style, but in Ireland, there's a fantastic upbeat version of that tune that is totally different. So Vaughan Williams is playing with this idea of the same music, but just told differently through different people's perspectives, and I really love that.
Wow. And this fits clearly into your premise for your whole concert, because isn't the whole idea of the concert the folk music origins of the classical music we play?
Exactly. And not only that, how it's still alive and kicking. You know, we talk in some of the kind of interview part, we talked to Mateusz Wolski about his experience of going as a child to Polish mountain weddings, and these folk traditions are still alive and well. And we have a couple of old friends of mine, Chris Stout, Katrina Mackay, who are a Scottish fiddle player, and a Klasach, the Scottish harp player, who are joining us. And these are people writing folk music now in real life. And we end with a very beautiful tune that is movingly a tribute to a friend of Chris's that passed at a very young age. So I wanted to show how not only is folk music this living, breathing tradition that's passed from ear to ear, and the influence of that on classical music, but also this is a thing that is still alive and well, and connects us. For me, it connects us to something really deeper. As you know, the episode's theme is roots, and for me, all of these folk tunes and folk ideas connect us in a way to our past in a really much deeper way than you would ever get from reading about a history of a place.
This is the first concert, and for me to get specific about it, every 2 weeks a new concert will be released, and the first one, the very concert that James and I are talking about right now, will be released today, and then in 2 weeks there will be the second, and 2 weeks after that, and so it will really go through the what would be the spring season of a concert of an orchestra. But what a great concept of folk music being still alive. A little parenthetical thing to this program, and I think another one that you're using later. You have so many secret weapons in the Spokane Symphony, including a mild-mannered trumpet player that just happens to be the poet laureate of Spokane. How good could it get?
I know, it's exactly that, and that's one of the other aspects that I really wanted to explore. You know, we have all these musicians on stage, and you know what, when you're in a live audience looking at an orchestra on stage, it's very easy to see them as a kind of just a wash of faces. But all of our players have passions and ideas and exciting things that they explore out with music that is amazing. So Chip Phillips, of principal clarinet, is a fantastic photographer, and we'll be featuring some of his photographs in one of our episodes. Chris Cook, as you mentioned, is the poet laureate, so we've got him later in an episode. He's reading some Emily Dickinson, but he's also in this first episode reading as a Czech, a very silly Czech folk story after the Dvořák serenade. So yeah, I also wanted to feature, you know, we're talking to musicians individually too, because, you know, obviously if we have masks on, you can't see them. And I wanted to, again, use this advantage of digital for people to really get to know our musicians a little bit better. So we have these little interviews dotted around. You know, I talked to Helen Byrne, one of our cellists, our assistant principal cellist, about what Mozart means to her, and Katie Upton, principal horn. You know, how did Mozart write for the horn? Why is he important in the evolution of her instrument? And we just get a little glimpse of these different people and see their ideas and thoughts and passions, and hopefully, even though we're masked when we're playing, that means that people can really start to connect to these wonderful people in our community.
Full information on the Spokane Symphony's new virtual series is available at spokanesymphony.org. Speaking of virtual performance, this week Vern Windham welcomed cellist Kevin Heckmut-Panna and Gonzaga University Dance Department head Suzanne Ostersmith for a preview of a special collaboration. Gonzaga University Theater and Dance presents Pay the Price, a virtual recital highlighting diversity, equity, and inclusion issues. Kevin is musician for the program. While here, he played for us a selection from the program, this by 20th century Hungarian composer Zsuzs Ligeti. Online broadcast of the virtual recital Pay the Price is at 7:30 Saturday evening, April 10th. Look for it online at the Gonzaga University and Dance website. Netflix's Murder Among the Mormons gives another look into the mind of a killer, says Dan Webster in this review.
What with the recent death of Joseph Duncan, not to mention the various mass shootings that have occurred over the past few weeks, the question rises yet again of what motivates someone to commit murder. For those of you who need to be reminded, Duncan is the guy who admitted to the 2005 killing of four people, including 9-year-old Dylan Groen, and of kidnapping both Dylan and his 8-year-old sister, Shasta. Duncan, who ended up being sentenced to death, died Sunday of brain cancer in an Indiana federal penitentiary. The larger question of why anyone would perform such an act, Duncan's crimes being particularly heinous, has been explored in any number of psychological studies, but too, it makes up a whole genre of movie projects, not to mention miniseries offerings from both cable TV channels and streaming services. Case in point, the Netflix miniseries Murder Among the Mormons, a 3-episode study of the events involving a series of deadly Salt Lake City bombings in 1985. That title, which is what co-directors Jared Hess and Tyler Meesom gave to their project, is titillating in and of itself. As author John Krakauer and others have made clear, violence isn't exactly unknown to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. In his 2003 nonfiction book, Under the Banner of Heaven, Krakauer focuses on two brothers who committed murder ostensibly because one of them had received a revelation from God. Krakauer also cites both the shooting death of church founder Joseph Smith in 1844 and the infamous 1857 Mountain Meadows Massacre, in which a group of Mormons and Paiute Indians attacked a wagon train of non-Mormons and ended up killing between 120 and 140 of the travelers. From this, one could conceivably expect that a miniseries titled Murder Among the Mormons would tie the church itself with the 1985 bombings that took the lives of two people and seriously injured a third. But the link turns out to be only tangential. Instead, what Hess and Meesom end up doing is giving us a lengthy, involved look at a man. Some describe him as a genius, though it's fairly clear that he's somewhat of a sociopath, who found a way to take his talents and fool everyone around him, from his own family to LDS church elders, in one of the cleverest con schemes ever devised. And it was only when he was on the verge of discovery that that same man turned to violence. The man in question is Mark Hoffman. Raised in the LDS church, Hoffman showed early promise as a Mormon scholar. He achieved fame for his ability to find ancient documents, many pertaining to early LDS church history. And for a time, while carrying on a normal life, getting married, fathering 4 children, he made a living by selling such documents, a number of them, to LDS church elders. Then in October of 1985, the bombings rocked Salt Lake City. One killed a prominent rare documents collector, and the other the wife of another collector. Shortly afterward, a third explosion seemed to target Hoffman himself. At first, it looks as if the church itself was complicit in the bombings, as some of the documents Hoffman had uncovered directly conflict with traditional LDS teachings. But as it turns out, Hoffman had faked everything. His skills as a forger, many of which he developed by himself, had allowed him to create documents that fooled everyone who saw them. One was a fake letter from an early church elder that claimed Joseph Smith had been led to the famous gold plates he'd found in a field, not by an angel, but by a white salamander. In debt, yet on the verge of making a $1 million deal, Hoffman was afraid that his life was crashing down around him. So he targeted the men he thought would discover his forgeries. He also considered suicide, though that wasn't successful. Hess and Meesom unfold all this in an intentional, non-chronological manner. They begin with the bombings, then move back and forth in time to create a sense of drama, making Hoffman's story a mystery that they crack over the three near one-hour-long episodes. They interview a range of those involved in the investigation, from Hoffman's wife and friends to the Salt Lake detectives and prosecutors who worked the case. And they augment all this with a lot of background footage of Salt Lake City itself, drawing the obvious connection between Hoffman and the church that he tried so hard to take advantage of. Hoffman refused to cooperate with the filmmakers, so his motivation comes only in the recorded interviews that he gave, both at the time of his arrest and later. And it is through those alone that we get some sense of his purpose. He wanted to destroy people's faith in the church, and he didn't care who got hurt while he did it. The mystery of murder among the Mormons is no more complicated than that. The mystery of Mark Hoffman, by contrast, remains locked deep within his own dark soul. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Dan Webster.
Dan Webster writes about movies and more for Spokane7.com and hosts Spokane Public Radio's Movies 101, heard Friday evenings at 6:30 here on KPBX. Thanks for listening to Northwest Arts Review. I'm Jim Tevenin. Help today came from Chris Massini and Vern Windham. Thanks as well to Dr. Carlos Gill, James Lowe, Kevin Hekmatpana, and Dan Webster. The Spokane Symphony takes us out with the close of Beethoven 7. Please join us again next week for another Northwest Arts Review on Spokane Public Radio.